Can't see the K, though.
My name is Eat. No. It's anonymous. My name is Keith, and I'm a sexaholic.
Hey, Keith. Hey.
And I'm really grateful to be alive and sober and here. My sponsor told me that I should introduce myself by saying that I want to smoke a cigarette and have sex with my wife. I told him I didn't really want to do that. I mentioned it to Kelly, and she said she thought it'd be funny. And as I was thinking about it, and I talked to my sponsor again just this evening before this, I told him that, and he said again that he thought it would probably be the way to start out being honest. You know, as an addict, I have a problem being honest, you know. And he didn't care if it was funny or not. He just thought it was more important that I be honest. And then I thought, you know, I wonder, it's really amazing how many times in my life I sat out and I have these plans and ideas, and I mention them to my wife and my sponsor and other people in my life, and how many times they veto them. You know, they're like, Keith, that's not really a good idea. We think you should do this. And, you know, so that, I'm really nervous, and I need to say that too. you know, I've been thinking about how to incorporate my story and the promises, because always before, whenever we've talked or done, or I've done any talks myself, I've always, you know, it's just been my story. You know, I'm just Keith, sexaholic. I don't ever have a topic. You know, just talk. You know, fill up 40 minutes, fill up 50 minutes, whatever. You know, and so I asked my sponsor again, and this is a big theme in my life, is that I asked for direction today. And part of that is the reason why the promises are coming true in my life. You know, I used to not ask for direction, or I would, I like to say that the first years in the program, I took probably about 1 out of 40 suggestions. You know, I'd call people and I'd ask them a question or something, and they'd give me a suggestion. And 39 of those suggestions I throw away automatically, and one that seemed like it wasn't that tough, I'd do. And today, you know, it may be 3 out of 10. So it's, I'm not there. I'm not at a point where I'm entirely recovered, but I'm like, I'm at a point where I have more willingness today than I ever have. And I'm really grateful for that. The nature of my addiction is compulsive masturbation, fantasy, and pornography. It's very boring. Most people who come into Sexaholics Anonymous have acted out in more extreme ways than I have. I think it's funny that the reason why I'm here is because I tried harder than most people to quit acting out with less success than most people have. I tried every way I could possibly imagine, and it didn't slow this disease down at all. You know, it didn't. I mean, it didn't even make a dent. I guess it's kind of like jumping off a cliff and trying to, you know, flap my arms. And for some reason, it just didn't slow me down, you know. And at some point, in August through September 2002, there were pretty tough times in my life. And I was beat by this disease. My ego had a hole punched in it, and it's just enough to let God in, you know. And I don't even understand this God thing, but it's just enough to let this power greater than myself in that has given me some freedom from acting out. Now, you know, this whole thing with my story is they have interesting connections with Colorado. Some of the worst years of my life were spent in Colorado. I lived in Durango. I think it's 84 and 85. I lived in the Springs, the residence was actually in the Springs, and I was detained in Pueblo in the state hospital in 86 on my 16th birthday. I actually got to spend in that facility, in the maximum security facility that they had there at the time. I didn't even know if it's still open. That's been some years, and I know a lot of that stuff goes away. So I've had some fear and trepidation, too, about coming back to Colorado. We came back for 9 years ago, probably, and visited my sister. But in the promises, you know, it talks about this, and I was told to go through these. And I guess if I just tell my story, it's probably going to get them all blurred up and mixed up. You know, and it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. 9.5, step 9.5. You know, that's where, before we are halfway through, because we're talking about the ninth step in the big book on page 83. And, you know, before we're halfway through, and I can tell you how much step 9.5, this is what my sponsor told me. I'm a slow step worker. I don't suggest it. But just last week, I went and did the amends with my grandparents on my mom's side. My grandparents on my dad's side are deceased, and they haven't come up in any step work. I didn't really know them that well. I resented that grandma and was grateful that she lived long enough to treat my wife respectfully. And that eased a lot of those resentments, and I don't have any amends. But with my grandparents on my mom's side, I had some amends to make to them, and I was able to go up. And one of the things that, you know, we will not regret the past, you know, or we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness, is the next promise. All the amends I've made to people, right? If something happens, I don't feel any magic at the time. You know, I went and talked to my grandparents and sat down. It was nice, you know, and this and that. I hadn't seen them for a couple of years, even though they only live, you know, 15 miles from me. But I'd always had this shame, you know, of going around them. So I made these amends to my grandparents. And I've made amends to one of my sisters and one of my brothers and, you know, Kelly and the kids. And the amazing thing about a lot of these resentments or these amends that I've made with these people is that when I'm around these people, I have a freedom that I don't have with the people I haven't completed this step with. It's an amazing thing, you know, that, like with my brother that I owed money to because I was not managing my affairs. I was acting out instead of working. And then I had a hard time supporting my family. so I'd call my brother, hey, I need some money to pay my, as we were separated, and I needed money to pay my child support. And, you know, and stuff like that. And I, you know, made those amends back to him. And I have a great relationship with him. And my sister that lives in Nashville, actually, when we went there, I got a chance to make amends to her for some stuff that happened in Durango where I chased her with a machete. And now it's like, when I think about her and when I talk to her, it's just really at ease. It's at peace. It's like, this is okay. You know, I don't have that fear hanging over her. My other sister, who actually lives in the Springs here, I haven't had the opportunity to. You know, and that's really difficult. And I pray that the opportunity will come up with her. Now it says that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. This is one of those promises that has, to the most part, come true to me. Sometimes it took in the other fellowship in AA. I attended AA for 14 years before getting sober in SA. And in that fellowship, I went to a lot of low bottom meetings because I related with the guys that had just got out of prison and the guys that had done that because of my experience of being locked up in different psych wards. And I wasn't locked up in psych wards because, I mean, I was nuts. Okay, well, that's a pretty fair statement. But I was locked up in psych wards because I was criminally nuts. You know, I was a danger. And it wasn't like I had... and so I related with these guys. But for years, I would never talk about this experience. I would never talk about the fact that I had spent a year of my life in psychiatric units in the state of Colorado. So there was a big portion of my story that I just wouldn't share. And in working this step, I talk about it now in meetings when it's appropriate, whether it's an SA meeting or an AA meeting or whatever meeting I'm at. If it seems appropriate, it's on topic, I'll talk about it because it's part of what I've gone through. It's part of my life. You know, some of the things when, like when Kelly and me have conversations and stuff, sometimes, I don't know if it's that I regret the past. It's sometimes I wish I hadn't had to been such a jerk. And hurt so many people so bad to become teachable, you know. And I don't know if that's regretting the past. It's just like, you know, I'm grateful for where I'm at. I just wish it hadn't cost so many other people so much, you know. And, you know, that's something that I work on a daily basis. And part of my amends to my family, my wife and my kids, is not sitting down and going over every crappy thing that I did to them my whole life, because, I mean, there's a ton of them. And I don't always know when people like my children or my wife are willing to sit down and listen to this list, you know, but being willing to listen to them when they want to talk about the stuff that I've done, you know. Like our son, I attempted suicide in a garage on his 8th birthday. Well, when do I bring that up to him? Or do I just say, okay, he's going to remember it. And when he brings it up, or the family brings it up, hey, Dad, you remember the time the police and the ambulances and all those people were over? You know, do I listen to them or just shut them down? You know, that's part of the way. You know, and that's another thing with not regretting the past, just letting them talk about it and saying, you know, my deal. The next one here, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. I used to think I knew what peace was. You know, I think that did the thing say 90 or 99? Because we got here in 99.
It's like 99.
Okay, and I know we'd go to meetings and I'd talk at meetings and this and that, and I'd talk about every subject that was ever under the moon, as if I was the end-all and ultimate authority. And thank God some of my friends in SA are crossovers, too. And they've attended meetings with me in AA, and they attended meetings with me in SA, and they finally told me, shut up. We don't want to hear what you're saying because you're not living it. You know, and I'd talk about knowing serenity. I had no idea. I thought I knew what serenity was. Serenity was that kind of oblivion that you get when you act out enough that you don't feel anything anymore. You know, you know, that's drunk, not serenity. And, you know, today serenity is being okay no matter what's going on. You know, it's like, okay, God. You know, and that's something I actually have to work at. You know, I wish I could just like wake up in the morning and be like, okay, God, let's skip and dance through the day and I'm going to be okay. But oftentimes I happen to forget about God. It's just like not even there. And I'll get myself all disturbed and worked up and pissed off. And life is just not going to work. And, you know, this and that is going to happen. And I'll totally forget that God's there. And then I'll remember, okay, maybe I should say a prayer. My head will say, that isn't going to work. Every time I think about praying, my head says it's not going to work. Every time I pray, it works. My head always tells me a lie, you know. And the serenity, you know, when I actually got sober, I thought our marriage was over. Kelly had filed for separation, and there was restraining orders and different things there. And I had to appear in court and do different things and pay huge amounts of child support, which my disease had actually diminished my ability to earn an income. Even in very early sobriety, I wasn't earning as much as I had several years before. So I was having a really difficult time. And this is the first time I ever actually got to know what peace was. Because it's like, it's okay. You know, I have enough today. It's okay. You're going to be okay, Keith. Just keep doing what you need to do. You know, and kind of a little side note, I was told by an old-timer just, you know, about a month or so before I got sober to get on an injection to help with this disease, and I went ahead and did it, and I went ahead and acted out anyhow on it, and then I've continued to take that medicine, and I have guys call me. This guy gives them my number, and they call me, and they are looking for the magic bullet, so to speak. They want a medicine that will take care of this thing. And I always tell them that in my first 30 days, I was taking the shot, going to counseling, seeing my psychiatrist, because he was kind of freaked out by the medicine that I was taking. and going to between 2 and 5 meetings a day. And I don't ever hear from them again. Because they want to, you know, most of us want this magic. And that's what I thought when I got the shot. I thought, this would be it. Because I was looking for the formula to end this acting out, you know. I was tired of the pain of acting out. And I continued to act out even on the shot. And I always think it's funny because I'm really grateful that after I took that and went on the last acting out run that I went on, that I was actually willing and broken enough to go to 2 to 5 meetings a day. And it wasn't all SA meetings. It was other fellowships because it's almost impossible to go to 2 to 5. Well, I don't think there's 5 SA meetings a day in any town in North America. And that's part of the thing that during that first 30 days, too, I remember I was living in a part of Portland. My sponsor that I had at the time told me, if you can stay sober living there, you can stay sober living anywhere. And God kept me sober living there. You know, I lived there for a month, right in the crack section of town, you know. And when it was raining out, which it does, thankfully, a lot of times in the winter, that helped me a lot. And, you know, that was, you know, September through October, still raining stuff. On the clear nights, the streets were really noisy, you know, when it wasn't raining because the people were out in the streets, you know, getting their drugs and stuff. But somewhere in there, one of the Sundays, I wasn't working. I wasn't doing anything. I had some laundry to do. I got up and I went to the 7 o'clock meeting. And then there wasn't another meeting. There was other meetings scheduled throughout the day, but not an SA meeting until 7:30 at night. Our biggest meeting in the Portland area. And the amazing thing in that 12 hours between those two meetings, I was okay. And it was the first time I'd ever felt okay. I was going to 2 to 5 meetings a day because I couldn't sit still. I was withdrawing from my drug and my mind was going nuts. And I couldn't sit still. And the only place I felt comfortable halfway was in a meeting. But within that first 30 days, I started getting the freedom and the peace where I could sit there. And that really did. I mean, laundry is not that challenging of a task, you know. And sit there and do my laundry and clean up my room. And I watched a little NASCAR. And NASCAR is not that gravitating to me. It's something I can, you know, kind of as background noise. And just be okay. And what a miracle. I mean, that just being okay. And I tell people today, this is the reason why I come back. You know, I don't come back necessarily to stay sober. I have to stay sober to have that feeling. I come back because I want that feeling. You know, I want that serenity. I want to know peace. I want to feel peace. At about 2 months sober, I think it was, our 6-year-old daughter who had witnessed this, this life that, I had brought into our home, who her dad wouldn't show up. You know, me, I wouldn't show up at home, or even after we were separated, I wouldn't show up at visitations and this and that. And she has some, probably kind of like her dad, she has some mental health issues, you know. And she snapped at 6. Some of it's biological. But a lot of the situation. And during that time when we had to hospitalize her 2 different times and we were separated, and I think the restraining orders, we thought they were lifted. I'm not sure they were 100% legally lifted at the time. We'd went to court and they had been lifted, and so I could hang out with the kids or take the kids to doctor's appointments and do this and that. So I was able to go and be a part of that. And to watch her just lose it and be okay. And, you know, talk to my sponsor and go to my meetings and know, you know, this kid is going to be okay. If I just, you know, this is going to be okay. I don't know. I didn't know really what's going to happen with her. I didn't know whether she's going to continue to slide downhill or whether her treatment or whatever would help. And, you know, so, but knowing that I'd be okay, you know, was okay. The next promise is, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. other than probably my favorite person in the world to talk to, actually, not probably, realistically, my favorite person in the world to talk to or listen to is Kelly. Other than that, it's sexaholics. You know, I prefer to talk to sexaholics over alcoholics. I kind of get nervous. I don't say this to people, but when I meet people that I really like, you know, in the outside world, I kind of wonder if I'm going to run into them in meetings sometimes. Maybe I should just slip them a brochure. And the funny thing is we talk a language here that I haven't heard anyplace else. You know, I mean, I'm a construction worker, and I mean, you hear all the sort of stuff on the jobs. We talk about the same sort of stuff to talk on construction sites, but in a form of language that's actually healing and healthy. And it's only here. You know, we go to church and stuff like that, and I'm sure if they heard my story, and our old church knew my story, our new church doesn't. I'm sure if they heard my story, they'd be like, well, that's kind of nice. Stay away from our kids, you know. It's only here that my story has really any value, you know. Out there, I mean, you know, people don't want to hear it. You know, people don't want to know the depths that my mind trolls. You know, they don't care. They just want to know that, okay, Keith, you're going to show up and do the job you're told to do, or you're going to pay your bills, or you're going to do all that sort of stuff. Here, when I'm talking to people, we had a newcomer come Tuesday night to our Vancouver meeting. And this is, you know, he shared, we did a newcomer breakout, and we talked about this and that. And at the end, he asked a question. And his question was, you know, and he looked at me and he said, is it possible to live without lusting? You know, I understood what he's talking about, because I didn't believe it was possible to live without lusting. But I know today, and I could tell him with confidence, and the other guys in the meeting could tell him with confidence, it is possible to live without lusting. You know. And, you know, that comes from where I've been. That comes from not thinking, you know, I can't do this. I remember I used to call my sponsor, Tierney Gears of Acting Out, before he fired me. And I would call him and say, I just can't do this. And he'd say, I know. And if you just believe that, you'd be okay. You know? It's just really frustrating. You know, I can't do this. Well, duh, you can't. Read the first step. You know, and so that you know, that whole deal in knowing that, you know, a person, and I've heard people say this before, and I believe it's true, that if I can be kept sober, there isn't any reason why everybody else can't be. You know, my story isn't that much worse, or I wasn't, you know, it's like, I listen to people in meetings and in sexaholics in the way that we think, and I know that if I can be kept sober, then there isn't a sexaholic out there that can't be kept sober. And I believe that in the depths of my heart. And the other sexaholics I talked to, when I was, I think my sponsor's 15th birthday, when I was about 9 or 10 months sober, and I sat in that meeting. They gave him his chip, and they kind of did an AA style, you know, where they talk about the person. Most of our meetings, they just give you a chip, and they don't talk to you, they don't congratulate you, they don't do nothing, you know, we're just like, but this meeting, they kind of did an AA style, where people would say, you know, the things that this guy had done for them, or whatever, and I got to thinking, that guy had been sober every day, one day at a time, for 15 years, and the thing I realized, and I got in that meeting, was that no matter what happens today, it can't be as bad as all those 15 years put together. Because a lot of stuff happens in 15 years. I mean, I'd been sober 9 or 10 months, and a lot of stuff had happened already. Well, you know, crunch that down into 15 years, there isn't nothing that happens bad enough that I have to act out today, period. You know, and I believe that still today. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Again, you know, I don't know if it's quite the right word. I sometimes struggle with words. I'm not a big word guy. But at times I feel like the work that we are doing, you know, each of us members of Sexaholics Anonymous are doing, is very important. I mean, not only to me, I mean, I talk to people because it keeps me sober, but it's also important to life, to the general. I feel like there's value there. I feel like, you know, that possibly, you know, I can be helpful. You know? I think in dealing with my children, I'm, you know, that whole deal with, you know, I woke up one day and I had five kids, you know. I mean, it's kind of the way I feel, you know. I was there in a kind of a brownout stage for all those years, and it's like all of a sudden, and now it's like, and now it's like, okay, how do I be a dad? You know, how do I parent these children? And there's some value there. I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious there's some value there. And I can only do that by being a member of Sexaholics Moms, by working this program. You know, and at work, you know, that I'm not drifting along, losing ground at work anymore. You know, it's crazy. I decided to start my own business and decide to see what God would do. There's something in As Bill Sees It where he's writing a letter to a guy who's going to try a new career, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and he says, as long as you're willing to try and it's just an experiment, you'll be okay. And so I've tried to live that, and for years I stayed in the same job with the same employer and going backwards because I was afraid that I wouldn't have enough money to act out. Well, towards the end of my disease, I wasn't carrying any money. If I had money, and then I'd go to the meeting, and I had Seventh Tradition money in my pocket, and sometimes it'd be $5, because I was afraid of carrying money, no credit cards, and I'd have the obsession to act out, and I'd call somebody, and they'd say, throw the money out the window, so I'd throw the money out the window, right, and then I'd find myself stealing porn, and it's like, how does that work, you know? I kind of missed the whole thing of surrender, you know. It doesn't matter how many dollars you throw out the window. If you don't surrender, you're right to act out. You end up acting out. But that whole feeling, you know, and I feel like today more than ever before in my life that there's value and meaning to my life. You know, there's a purpose for Keith to get up every morning, you know, and to do his prayer and meditations and to call his sponsor and to go to work and to do the best he can and to come home and to go to meetings and to just be who he is. And always before, it felt like, you know, I was, I did attempt suicide. It was kind of a chicken way of doing it. It wasn't very serious, but I always wanted God to take me away. You know, I didn't want to actually have to do the dirty job of committing suicide, but I didn't want to live anymore either. You know, it's just like, this is too much. This is crap. There's no reason for me to be here. And today I actually feel like there's a reason to be alive. You know, I'm quitting smoking. I have been working on it for months. That's why I said I wanted to smoke a cigarette. I have about 3 weeks without smoking. And I had 30 days before that, and then I smoked for 8 days. I'm doing kind of the same. It's crazy. I wish I could learn this stuff and transfer it over from one problem to another, but it seems like I have to relearn it in each of the problems. but one of the reasons why I want to quit smoking is because I'm trying to tell my higher power that I want to live, you know. So I'm trying to do things in my life to say, I care about my life. My life is important to me. I want to live. So I'm trying to change my behaviors to express that. I mean, I don't know what God's going to say, but that's what I want to say. Whereas when I feel like I'm smoking and I'm doing all this other crazy stuff, I don't really care, you know. And I'm also trying to have that message to my wife and to my kids and the other people that are around me, you know, that I want to be here, you know. I want to be a part of this thing. This is the cool show on earth, you know. Pretty much the only one life is. But we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. You know, and I really like this one is partially true, I think, sometimes, you know. A lot of times I get sidetracked and think that I need certain things, and that's always selfish. Anytime I need something, it's selfish and self-centered, you know. And when I'm more interested in what I need than in what I'm getting or what God is going to give me, then I am, you know, not losing interest in selfish things and getting, I'm obsessing about stuff. You know, so I work on this one. You know, that whole thing of being, you know, thinking, and there is a story in here, and I can't, you know, where she says at the end of her story that when she does the stuff, the program, I'm terrible. I read this book over and over and over, 2 pages a day usually, and I cannot quote it. I mean, for nothing, you know. So it's not her lack of not reading it; it's just for lack of the fact that this stuff for me is foreign, and I really struggle comprehending it a lot of times. You know, some of the stuff will come through. But a lot of times I lose it. But she talks about when she you know seeks her power, her higher power's will, she gets what she needs, and then she finds out that what she needs is what she wants. And that's what I'm finding is true in my life too. That when I'm seeking, you know, okay, God, thy will not mine be done. God provides what I need, and in the end, what I need is really what I want. You know, even though I didn't realize it. So, self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. You know, this one is kind of an interesting one. You know, my whole life, one of my friends in the program, he used to tell me, aren't you getting sick of being the center? He's kind of rude about it. You know, he's one of those crossover guys. He's got that AA in your face sort of mentality, you know. And he'd tell me that over and over and over again. Aren't you tired of being in the center? And my whole life, from the time I was a very little boy, you know, we traveled around the country quite a bit, living in different places and this and that. And I always looked to get what I could out of each place that we lived in. You know, I looked to get everything that I possibly could out of that place. You know, if it was stealing money out of neighborhood cars, or if it was stealing porn from a guy that lived in and rented a room from a house, or, you know, it was whatever. I took whatever I wanted. I tried. My life was all about getting what Keith thought he wanted all the time. That was the focus of Keith's life. I carried that through into our marriage, into absolutely everything that I did, my job, everything. It was all about getting what Keith wanted to get. Today, and this one here too, I spend time in prayer and meditation, a whole attitude and outlook on life. You know, today, my life is about accepting God's will for Keith, whatever it is, that day, whatever it presents itself that day. You know, I make a lot of beautiful plans. You know, I sit down in the morning and I think about what's going to happen that day, you know, and I have all these ideas and schemes and plans that are going to go through, you know, and it used to really bug me when these would fall apart. Oftentimes, I leave the house at 7 o'clock, and by 5 after 7, my plans for the day are scrapped. You know, now my job is to accept that and keep moving on. You know, and okay, I had all these plans. I told you what I wanted, God, and you're saying no. And that's how my attitude and you know, has an outlook upon life has changed, is that it's okay today if my life is flexible. It's okay today if the things, the beautiful plans that Keith creates, which generally are not very beautiful, but they look beautiful in my head. If those go away and are replaced by something else, fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. The reason why I am nervous standing up here is because I'm afraid of what you guys will think about me. You know, that's true. I have to surrender my right to worry about what people think about me. I've been told for a long time, it's none of my business what anybody else thinks about you, Keith. I have a harder time practicing that than actually hearing it or saying it out loud. And so the fear of people, and I'm less fearful of people today than I would have been some years ago. You know, the economic insecurity will leave us. It's kind of funny. We have this. I have this project going on at work. Actually, I'm done with this project at work, and this lady owes me a substantial amount of money, and I've been attempting to collect it from her in a way that doesn't cause me to have to make her amends. You know, that's kind of I hate making amends, and it's been really amazing because sometimes it's come right down to the wire, and I haven't known how I was going to pay my guys, the guys that work for me, and then like the day before I have to have it paid, somehow some money will come through, and God will take care of them and me. And through this experience, I'm beginning to learn that it's okay. You know, I'm going to be okay. My kids are going to be fed and clothed and housed. The people that work for me are going to be paid. And, you know, God's going to take care of it. And then ultimately, too, in the end, if the business fails, who cares? I just get a different job. I was looking for a job when I got this one. And having that kind of outlook, you know, and it takes some work. You know, this whole program is about willingness to work these, you know, to practice these principles. And it takes some work to maintain that kind of attitude because sometimes I want to get really crappy and I want to fantasize about knocking this lady's house down, you know, and go through those sort of things in my head. And, you know, doing all that stuff. But, you know, as I pray about it and surrender it and actually look at what God is doing for me in my life, I'm okay. It doesn't matter, you know. If that happens, it'll be nice. But until that happens, I'll be okay, you know. And that's really nice to have that feeling, you know. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Twice in my sobriety, I've went on to job sites and found pornography, you know, and it's kind of funny because always before in the past that was a good reason to act out. Oh, God gave it to me. you know, if God's given me porn, that's a pretty baffling situation, being as porn kills me. Both of those times, I couldn't live with the porn there on the job site and work there for 2 weeks, you know, and have it there and not wonder, you know. So one time there was a couple guys there. So I picked it up, wadded it up without trying not to look at it. And I took it to the super of the subdivision. And I said, you need to do something with this. And I gave it to him. That's intuitively. I didn't even think about it. It's just like, there's a magazine. I need to get rid of it because I can't have it hanging out because I'm allergic to this stuff. You know, scrunch it up, hand it to the guy. And I knew he was kind of a religious guy, so I knew he'd be kind of like, okay, you know, take care of it. Some guys you wouldn't want to do that with because they'd want to sit down and look at it with you. But that particular guy was okay. And the time before that, actually we were going to be there for about a day or two. And I knew the garbage guy was going to come by. And I took it and I had a bunch of wrappers and I just shoved it underneath the wrappers and then left the job. That's one of the blessings of being self-employed is you can leave. Like, okay, the garbage guy is going to come by and he's going to scrap this thing out and I can just kind of float the schedule until that happens. And that was another way of, you know, okay, I intuitively know how to handle this situation. So you used to baffle us because, you know... Then the other, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I'm sober today. I've been sober, sexually sober, since September 24th of 2002. If on September 30th even, or September whatever of 2002, 2003, you'd have told me that that'd be true today, I would have not believed you. I didn't believe that this program would work until we went to Nashville and we did the couples meet. And I was terrified. That's a fun. I was so terrified. I blocked that out. I just like, I'm not going to think about it. We get into the room, and we sit down at the table, and I lean over, and I say, Nancy, what's the topic? Because I totally like, just like, I wasn't going to deal with it. You know, I was just not going to deal with it. And she told me the topic, and we talked. I don't remember what it said, and it went okay. And I left that room, and I realized, you know, before September 2002, people were telling me to shut up. You know, we're tired of hearing you talk, Keith. You know, you just need to start showing us. We don't care what you say. Start showing us. And something had happened, and now people actually asked me to talk. And that's when I actually first began to realize that this promise was coming true. Because they didn't ask me to talk because I was a cool guy. They didn't even really know me, you know. You know, they asked me to talk because God is doing something for me that I couldn't do for myself. You know, the first steps is we're powerless and our life has become manageable. You know, I am powerless over lust. I cannot stop. I cannot stop masturbating. I cannot stop buying porn or looking at porn or doing all of that stuff. And, you know, I'm sober and free. And if that isn't a bigger example, you know, and the fact that we're married. I was just telling Kelly, we were walking around, and I told her how grateful I was that we were able to be here together. You know, because that was not a very probable situation a few years back. you know. And the thing that I realize about these promises, you know, that's all of these promises is the fact that the reason why the promises are cool, the reason why the fact that they're coming true in my life is really cool, is because the depths of despair that I've got to experience, you know. I think there's people out there who are non-addicts. I believe they probably experience these promises without having to work the steps. You know, so for them, it's no big deal, you know. It's like, this is just the way life is. We have friends, and I hear stories about them and their behaviors and this and that, and things they do without even thinking about it and with absolutely no consequence, and I'm absolutely floored and amazed. You know, people live that way, and they stay connected to their higher power. You know, people can do things that I can't do. And one of the big things for me, too, is today, as a result of being beat up by this disease, I live by a certain set of rules. They're my rules. They're not Kelly's rules. They're not anybody else's rules. They're Keith's rules. You know, I don't drive down certain streets. There's a funny story about that. I called my sponsor and was complaining about as being harassed by Kelly's sponsor and Harvey, her husband. And I called him and was harassing him because I'd stopped taking the medication at about 7 or 8 months, and then I'd actually looked at porn. And they were wanting me to get back on the shot, and I wasn't wanting to at that time. And I called my sponsor and was complaining about how rude these people from these old-timers from Nashville were. And I happened to cast out the fact that I was driving past a video store. And he called me back, and he said, whether you take any medicine or not, if you drive past those places, you know, what he said, recovery will look like for you as if you're not driving past those places, you know. And he was very rude about it. He wasn't even very nice. He's usually generally a fairly nice sponsor. He likes to make fun of me. But he's not generally mean like that. And knowing that, you know, then we get to the, are these extravagant promises, you know. The next line is the three words, we think not, which we usually say in the meeting, you know, when the promises are read. most meetings I go to that read the promises, everybody, you know, says that, those three words, you know. And then it says they are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. I think that's kind of important. You know, in the fifth chapter, after some debate, Bill wrote, "Rarely have we seen a person fail, necessarily fall their path." According to the stuff I've learned, he wanted to say never, but it was changed to rarely. And there's other examples in here, and that's the most, but where they use a word that isn't, and again, my language skills are failing me, but you know, they use a word that leaves some room for wiggle, like rarely. You know, it's possible that one out of a million alcoholics fails after completing his 12 steps. That's what my mind interprets rarely as. Here it says always. So they took rarely before the 12 steps. And at 9.5, they're saying always. So, because if there's a 1 in a million chance that these aren't going to work, they won't work for me. You know what I mean? Because I'm always the exception. That's my life, you know. They'll always materialize if we work for them, you know. And what time is it? How much time? 8, okay. You know, this is the deal. And I a lot of the things that I like to talk about with people is, you know, I have guys call, and I talk to 5 or 6 drunks every day, sexaholics, and I'm really grateful for that. It keeps me sober, you know. I talk to my sponsor, and I hear guys doing this sort of crap that I did to my sponsor. You know, I want this, and I, you know, I want to be sober, and I want to do this, and I want to, and I always ask them, what are you willing to do? You know, are you willing to get on your knees? You know, are you willing to call somebody every day? Are you willing to keep your hands above your waist no matter what happens? Are you willing to drive a mile out of your way? You know, are you willing? You know, and I ask them those questions because that's what it really boils down to. It doesn't boil down to wanting. I could want this thing, and I wanted this thing all day long. I just wasn't ever willing to do anything for it, you know. And the real point in life for me came where I got beat hard enough, and I became willing enough to say, okay, I'll do whatever it takes, you know. And the guys laugh because my sponsor I have now fired me several months before I got sober. He's kind of nice about it. He said, if you're not willing to listen to what I'm telling you, you need to find a new sponsor. So I found a new sponsor, and he was exactly what God wanted for me at that time, right? And one of the things, and this is kind of funny, is people, he told me to wear welding gloves to bed at night, and I did, you know, and it's a funny thing, you know, that, you know, because they're, I mean, I'd wake up and, you know, they're kind of greasy, and it's really gross. But I had reached a point in my life where I was willing to do absolutely anything if it helped me, you know, help give me a second to actually work my program, because that's really what it takes for me, is it takes a second. The thought comes in, I got to get it out. You know, it takes a second, you know, before, you know. And I'm really, really grateful. This is a beautiful facility. You know, I'm grateful that you guys asked us to come out, grateful for the committee to, you know, put this thing together, you know. And I'm grateful that I think my hour's done. Yeah, cool.